Hello, welcome to the New Stack Makers, a podcast where we talk about at-scale application development, deployment, and management.
Welcome to another edition of the New Stack Makers. Today we have an interesting guest, Julian Fischer, who is the CEO of a German integration firm called AnyNines. They offer tailored cloud solutions, and they've been doing a lot of work on Cloud Foundry and increasingly on Kubernetes. And Julian, an observer of both technologies, has a lot of interesting insights into both of these technologies. Julian, hello, and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Let's dive right in. So AnyNines, this is a company that came to our attention fairly recently. Could you tell us how the company got started? And also, where did the name AnyNines come from?
Well, we actually started as a Ruby on Rails shop back in 2008 under a different name. We've basically been hosting and developing web applications ever since. We actually started with a lot of physical clusters back in 2008, went through the virtualization, did a lot of with OpenStack, and finally arrived in the Cloud Foundry ecosystem, which transformed our company into a company focusing on application developer platforms in 2013. And the transformation took a few years to happen. And the name AnyNines emerged from the ability and the desire to have platforms with high availability. And because they are custom built, some would be more available than others, depending on the customer's requirement. And as uptime is measured with the number of nines, we basically said, well, we give you any number of nines. It's just you tell us what you need and we build the according platform for it.
Excellent. I was kind of surprised. You still have a thriving Cloud Foundry practice. Where does Cloud Foundry fit into the ecosystem? What are the benefits to Cloud Foundry in 2022?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. A lot of the conversation today is about Kubernetes, but the Cloud Foundry ecosystem has been very strong, especially for large corporates, and they've been picking up momentum in the years 2012 to 2017. There was a lot of discussions around Cloud Foundry. But the thing is, Cloud Foundry has always been a heavyweight. It's not something you download after a long job in the office and play around a bit and get a fast reward. It has been the technology together with Bosch, an abstraction layer to automate virtual machine workloads in an operating system and infrastructure independent manner that still has extraordinary skills, especially for application developer platforms that have large scale. So the basic idea of Cloud Foundry was to get Heroku-like user experience into an on-premise data center or into an AWS account. And a lot of large organizations within their digital transformation journey, they invested into Cloud Foundry to get their application developer productivity up with this kind of no-ops experience so that application developers, they can focus on their application development instead of fiddling around with complicated infrastructure automation. Cloud Foundry was very appealing and is very appealing to achieve that first journey into a digital transformation. So organizations with hundreds or thousands of developers or even 10,000 of developers, they had this central platform with a central marketplace where data services could be integrated and application developers could push their applications, dividing the organization into so-called orgs, organizations in Cloud Foundry, and that divided up into spaces. So it came with a multi-tenancy model, a marketplace, and an entire lifecycle management for the whole thing. So customers are hosting thousands and sometimes 10,000 of applications on Cloud Foundry, and all is automated with the Bosch technology and can be operated with a fistful of people. So that's quite extraordinary and gave us a lot of momentum because we invested and, we knew how to get those things going. We developed also a lot of data service automation to make that Cloud Foundry into a full turnkey solution.
Excellent. There are development platforms being built around Kubernetes, but in a way, it still offers an advantage for offering, like you said, a platform as a service for the enterprise. I guess there's a certain size of enterprises it is good for. Like, it seems to be big enough to support a Cloud Foundry operation, but they also need to create a lot of apps as well.
That's absolutely true. I mean, if you know Heroku a bit and if you know Cloud Foundry a bit, you know that there's a set of requirements called the 12-factor manifest or, having cloud native applications. They must have certain qualities, for example, tend to be stateless where state is stored in backing services. data services like Postgres or RabbitMQ or Kafka or whatever. Sometimes you don't have those requirements met with applications that are already been developed a while ago. And this is where Cloud Foundry isn't the best match. But if you have a lot of those 12-factor compliant applications, a Cloud Foundry system is providing you an absolute awesome economy of scale. So if you think about the overhead, the operational overhead a single application has, once it fits that pattern, there is, to my knowledge, nothing alike that provides the same operational efficiencies. But just to give you an example, we have an operations team and we are operating dozens of Cloud Foundry environments for customers across the world, across the globe, on AWS, on Azure, on AliCloud. And you know, it's the same stack, right? We do have some little deployment manifests, but it's a declarative description of the platform itself, which can be rolled out across infrastructures across the globe. And if you think about Log4Shell, or if you think about Shell Shock a few years ago, those are scenarios where you have to turn over, let's say, operating systems or components very quickly. And in some of these environments, there are 5,000 virtual machines running. And with just a few changes to YAML files, you push a button and they'll all be recreated. And those update waves may run for a week, but it's nearly effortless. If you think about the alternatives, for example, it means for such large organization to use Kubernetes instead, there are much more operational heterogeneities involved, which also creates more operational friction. We have more flexibility, but this is where Cloud Foundry versus Kubernetes still makes some points for Cloud Foundry. If the workload has a particular, say, regularity, Cloud Foundry provides significant economy of scale effects that Kubernetes cannot.
So the company has also been building up a Kubernetes expertise over the past few years. And I'm kind of curious as to where is the enterprise in terms of Kubernetes, in terms of where are they looking at it? Are they starting to use it? And what are the challenges in bringing Kubernetes to the enterprise?
There's no way around Kubernetes these days. Technology that has such visibility is being used already. It's being used for years. The problem, especially with large organizations, is that if you have scattered IT departments and they're already using Kubernetes, it may be the case that, you know, one department uses it on Azure, the other department uses Google, the third party uses whatever on Amazon, one is using EKS, one is using Kops, the other is using whatever, Rancho or something. There are so many ways on how to create a Kubernetes cluster. And once you created them, they basically sit there and to some degree, they represent infrastructure as well, because you can deploy stateful sets on top of them, and they have to maintain as well. So imagine, without any governance from central IT, over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, these individual departments have created their Kubernetes clusters in their particular way. How do you ensure that, for example, corporate policies are met? How do you ensure that you don't have a lot of operational overhead in those individual departments? And this is exactly where rubber meets the road, because over time, they figured that if they just let Kubernetes go, it will grow into little islands. And at some point, you want to integrate them. But once you actually let that happen for years, it's very hard to undo. So we highly recommend to approach Kubernetes with a good policy in place and a good strategy on how to bring these clusters together or use a unified toolset to do that. And there are some approaches, technologies in the CNCF, like Crossplane or Cluster API, and so they address all the problems and how to deal with a large number of clusters and how to federate them and group them together. But this is where corporates struggle, because to make sense of this technology, it has to work at scale that you don't have one Cloud Foundry and one Kubernetes cluster. You have one Cloud Foundry and many Kubernetes clusters. So how do you make sense of many Kubernetes clusters is one of the key challenges these corporate customers are facing.
Where is the state of art? We've been hearing a lot about managing multi-clusters or even multi-cluster federation, but what are the current challenges with doing that with Kubernetes?
The flexibility that Kubernetes allows makes it hard to make, you know, absolute statements about how it should be used, because it depends on the type of workloads you want to operate and what the function of Kubernetes is in particular organizational context. As we come from a lot of Cloud Foundry, we do have customers who, let's say, use Cloud Foundry for 12-factor like applications. so that there's a certain profile of applications that have affinity towards Kubernetes. One example is lift and shift applications, applications that are a bit older, or applications that need more flexibility. So in these scenarios, the clusters, they need custom configurations. And the question would be, how do you describe in a GitOps way, declaratively, a Kubernetes cluster with its workload and still pay respect to the operational responsibilities within an organization? Which means some clusters need to be fully managed because, for example, the cluster is used to deploy standard software. So the entire cluster is predetermined and all you want to do is hit a play button. In the other extreme, you have a cross-functional team with a lot of infrastructure knowledge, and they want to maintain the cluster themselves with a high customization of the cluster itself. And there were those teams in the middle where you'd have, let's say, a Kubernetes cluster, a set of well-selected, curated operators, let's say Postgres, RabbitMQ, Kafka, MySQL, whatever. And these extensions and the cluster itself is managed, but the workload is provided by an application team. So as you can imagine, these three scenarios, they also have impact on, let's say, the tools you have to provide and the way responsibilities are taken care of. So how to make upgrades and how to create a backup and recovery concepts and how to do monitoring and so on.
So it's not just a simple case of creating a generic set of clusters or one big supercluster and then letting, I guess, either the developers or if there's a line of business level operations teams, get at it. You have to reconcile it somehow across everything, but give everybody a certain amount of flexibility if they need it.
Exactly. We find ourselves, and also we are surprised about this to a certain degree, you know, coming from Cloud Foundry, where you had this one stack, you put it into a data center and people started using it. With Kubernetes, we find the situation that we need to tailor the automation solution to the needs of an organization. So the ideal Kubernetes platform reflects the inner structure of the IT of a particular customer much more, which is a big strength. And it's going to be a big strength once tools are really there. But currently, you still have to put in a lot of effort to get things right so that Kubernetes is operationally efficient to both the application developer as well as the operators.
Wow, that's pretty heavy, as people used to say. So it's not merely a matter of installing the app. It's a matter of customizing it to the actual how the organization works.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just give you a brief example. We have customers where, let's say there's one AWS account and the clusters are provisioned in that AWS account in separated networks, for example, or several VPCs. And, you know, this is the master bedroom, so to say, where everything happens. And other organizations, they use infrastructure tenants or infrastructure accounts, whether this is on AWS or Azure or AliCloud, doesn't matter, to already represent their business units. So you're not dealing, let's say, with one AWS account, but with a dozen. And then you have to reproduce your automation into these. Think about the cluster API. In this case, you'd have to have a managed cluster that's able to deploy into, you know, those different accounts. And then who is allowed to create such a cluster and how many? Because these things are costly, right? You're creating virtual machines behind the scenes. So how to restrict in a meaningful way access to the cluster API and apply quotas and so on that somehow reflect the necessities without getting in people's way, right? That's something that needs to be reflected within the tool chain.
For most organizations, is this something they should do in-house or is this a point where they would need, it'd probably be better to have a third-party integrator to kind of take on this work?
Well, this really depends on what knowledge within the company is. I mean, there are companies who have built a cloud-native team already and they don't need external help, where there's more collaboration with us where we move on forward automation tools that we commonly use or tools that they don't want to own. For example, we are developing operators such as a Postgres operator because we already do that with virtual machines. We have the knowledge. And other companies who need to have a partner who help them to extract the actual requirements, what the tooling of the platform, what the platform is about, and then select the CNCF products and put them together in a meaningful way, and then help them to get this thing up and running. And not only the one Kubernetes cluster, but the multitude of them.
Just to kind of back up for our audience, they might be familiar with Postgres, the database, but why would it be good to have an operator for Postgres within a Kubernetes environment?
For the customers with Cloud Foundry, we often have a situation that they already have, let's say, our data service automation, which also includes a Postgres. If they create a Kubernetes cluster, they can integrate that Postgres with their Kubernetes cluster so that they don't have to run a stateful set with Postgres inside of the Kubernetes cluster. And they gain benefits from that, from the strong isolation of the virtual machine. We recommend that, especially for customers with high expectations towards the Postgres. So banking, insurance, finances, they love to have databases in virtual machines because it's so solid. However, sometimes the contract to infrastructure is Kubernetes, where Kubernetes has basically established as a unified infrastructure abstraction, where, let's say, the company policy is to say, well, we don't want to get into bed with infrastructure providers too much because we don't want to have a vendor lock-in, which you immediately get if you buy into those vendor-specific services. So then having a Kubernetes only is very good because you can lift and shift, you know, a Kubernetes workload, wherever Kubernetes is. If your Kubernetes is your sole assumption, then it's also easy to move that workload. Let's say, for example, you started at a large infrastructure in a Kubernetes cluster, and then you want to move that distributed system in an edge scenario where all you have is a rack in, let's say, a plant, a factory site somewhere, and this rack runs the Kubernetes cluster. So if you have Postgres as an operator in Kubernetes, all you need is the Kubernetes assumption, and you can run the distributed system along with the operators, and Kubernetes is more or less self-contained. That's just one of the examples where an operator becomes handy. Another example would be when it's desired to have Kubernetes as the sole description of the distributed system. And, well, that's one way to get there.
Hey, I noticed on your website that you guys talk a lot about data services, and we've been covering data quite a bit. We haven't really thought about it a lot in terms of where it fits into the whole cloud native ecosystem. What are data services, and why should the enterprise think about them in that way?
In the past years, we had a lot of discussions and a lot of attention was evolving around container orchestration, right? So the idea of, you know, having an abstraction from the application server, like the Tomcats and the likes, the JBosses and whatever they've been in the past. Today, it's clear you put your application into a container somehow, whether this is using through a CF push or whether this is through, let's say, a Kubernetes deployment, doesn't matter. All these applications, they need to store state somewhere. There have always been data services, databases, message queues, and analytics service, and whatnot. The question is, what is the cloud native data service look like? If you have, you know, a declarative description of your application, you also want to have a declarative description of whatever takes care of your data. Because if your database goes down, your application is down. In our perception, and we started with that nearly a decade ago, is if you have something that takes care of your applications, you want to have something that has similar qualities that takes care of your data. And to us, this means if you have an organization where you deploy 10,000 apps, you're very likely going to have a similar amount of databases than data services. You know, the same operational efficiencies that apply to applications must apply to data services. And back then, nobody cared. They thought they'll get along with their chef recipes or, you know, integrating the Oracle database somewhere. And it turned out to be not the case. So now in Kubernetes, data on Kubernetes is a community we actively participate. People start to understand they also need to automate the lifecycle of their databases as well. This is something we highly encourage because we believe it's an integral part of any digitalization path and cloud native application development for sure.
What would that involve in practice? I got a Postgres database. How do I turn it into a data service?
We also have a cloud native application development department. We kept that because we believe that you need to have this one department where you have developers, application developers who struggle with your own product. So these people use our product. We figure out with them, how do we want them to operate? Well, they used to do CF push for everything, but we found out some applications don't really fit that model. What they do today is they declare how the cluster should look like. They declare what extensions they want. They declare where the application comes from using GitOps as one of the prime paradigms. So there's a declarative description about the entire thing. They push a button and a CI/CD pipeline takes that and makes it a reality. It creates a cluster. It deploys the extensions, including operators for data services, including creating virtual machine-based data services where necessary, including the application deployment. So with these automations in place, the application developers can truly act in an on-demand self-service fashion because they can deploy such a system on short notice. We have, for example, our customer here is an agency. They sell those customized application systems to their clients. Things happen where they call us and say, well, look, we have this short notice sales pitch in 2 hours. We need to have their CI, their corporate identity, in that application, and we need it with a live deployment within the hour. With the templates that we've created, you can just describe that, push a button, and 10 minutes later, you have the running thing in a production-grade manner, including monitoring, including automated backups, right? So that's basically what we want to make reality for all our clients, is to have that on-demand self-service ability, create that local autonomy application developers need so that they can have, you know, a productive day.
That's a nice summary. You had mentioned GitOps before. Now, this is the process of putting infrastructure changes and code changes into Git and have it deployed automatically. What's your take on GitOps? Is this something, do you see using this in the future? Do you use it now? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not very passionate about GitOps as a thing. What I'm passionate about is to have a declarative way of describing my distributed system. And once I have this declaration, that I can hand it over to something and say, build that thing for me. If you do a lot with YAML, which is basically just a text file format, right? Git is very useful because it does versioning of text files very well. And because Git also, you know, has many integrations where you can have and trigger things after you do a commit and you have branching and forking, it seems to me that it is natural to use Git because it has such a wonderful synergy with the idea of having a declarative description of a distributed system. You know, to be honest, if there's tomorrow something else that does this job better, I'd be happily jump to that. But it's the idea of having a declarative description and a control that makes it happen that's the essence to it.
There's nothing inherent about Git itself, is what you're saying, to make that possible.
Just in so far as it does this job quite well. But it is a tool. It's not a purpose on its own. You want to have a declared statement. And we have been using, for example, a Git and Git hooks and so on in the context of Cloud Foundry and Bosch deployments as well. There we also had CI/CD pipelines using Concurse instead of Argo CD, but there were many alikes, same approach.
All right, fantastic. Are there any other aspects of NE9s or anything else in the industry you think you might want to mention in this podcast?
You know, over the past 2 years where the world has ended several times, I can tell you, I'm so proud of the team and all the people that are within the company. I had many wonderful moments where it was just humans. You know, it was not about, you know, work alone. It was people, you know, had fear, what will happen to the customer base and so on. And we've seen so many customers, you know, having our backs. They know that we've been helping them. They have been helping us. And it was a wonderful experience. And I have to say, this job is more about people than it is about technology. And especially in the past 2 years, I've seen so much good in people. You know, I always thought that the IT industry here is a special place to be, and I'm very grateful to be part of that. And so I hope you have similar experiences.
Actually, yeah, now that you kind of described it, we went through a similar thing as well. I don't know if we're out of it yet, but we're on this side where a lot more coherent as a team, which is something I never would have thought about before. But yeah, you're right on the money with that. Julian, thank you so much for getting us up to speed. That was very educational. And thank you for our listeners for tuning in.
Well then, thank you and bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe on Simplecast to listen to more episodes of the New Stack Makers. Then create and share your favorite audiogram using our Simplecast player. For more great stories, go to thenewstack.io.